This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City and KVMR.org. This is Eric Tome. I'm going to be here till 2 p.m. Today's program focuses on the dire state of the American economy and of our economic relations in general. I'm going to have three guests on looking at different ways of approaching our economy. First, the most horrendous, probably. It's Stephen Greenhouse, the labor and workplace correspondent for the New York Times. His book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, has just come out in paperback. And I'll be talking to him in just a few seconds. Then later in the program, Sacramento writer Andrew McLeod's book, Holy Cooperation, Building Graceful Economies. And at the end of the program, I'll talk with Charles Durrett, one of the founders of the Co-Housing Company. He's going to be talking later this week about sustainable and cooperative building practices. I'm going to start with the worst news, probably, with Steve Greenhouse of the New York Times, who's written The Big Squeeze, which is about as depressing a compendium as I've ever seen. But welcome to Booktown nonetheless. I should first say how grateful I am that the New York Times actually has such a position. So many newspapers, when they think of business, they only cover it from the financial point of view. You've been doing this for, what, 13, 14 years?
Yes, I have.
And I said before that I find your book, unfortunately, very depressing. I hope you haven't gotten too depressed in that time.
Well, many people tell me they actually enjoy the book because they are very happy to see a book that really tells it like it is, that really describes what it's like for, you know, factory workers who are laid off and what they try to do with the rest of their life, or, you know, white-collar workers whose jobs are shipped to India, or, you know, workers in some wonderful companies that do a great job and how they treat their workers. And I think people say they like the book and aren't just depressed by it because it really explains how the nation's workers have been squeezed in many, many ways. Before the latest economic crisis began.
Right, and what I actually, when I say it's depressing, I'm actually very grateful because what you've done is put facts that I knew a little bit of here and a little bit of there all together in one place and go through it very thoroughly. I think not only do you talk about horrendous working conditions, union busting, lack of health care, minimum wages, and so on. To me, the most important parts of the book are when you talk about the social contract that we had at one point between workers and industry and how that has just almost been wiped away in the last 20 or 30 years. Could you explain a little more about that?
Sure. In the book, I really try to explain broadly what's been happening with American workers, how, you know, wages have stagnated and health benefits are getting worse and pension benefits are getting worse and, you know, this does sound pretty depressing, Eric, but I'm just trying to describe what's happening.
Right.
And, you know, job security is deteriorating, and many jobs are shipped overseas. And, you know, I have a chapter that's called The Rise and Fall of the Social Contract. And in that chapter, I explain how after World War II, when unions were stronger and companies were more willing to share their prosperity with their workers, that this wonderful social contract formed that provided good wages and good benefits and good job security. And thanks to that social contract and the very good wages, benefits, and job security, the United States really developed the world's largest, richest middle class. And we really had these golden decades of the 1950s and 60s, you know, where prosperity increased for most, but not all, but for most Americans. But then starting in the late 70s, early 80s, with, you know, increases in imports, and with Wall Street demanding, you know, greater profits and higher share prices, and the country moving right, there was a much greater squeeze put on the nation's workers, and the so-called social contract really started to break down. And, you know, wages have basically stagnated over the past decade or two. Companies have not shared their profits as much. And as many of your listeners know, health benefits have been getting worse for workers. The good old pensions of old have been replaced with the fairly lousy 401ks that everyone seems to be complaining about. And, you know, job security has, in many ways, gone down the drain. And we've seen these huge waves of downsizing. Even Microsoft announced, you know, a week or two ago that it's laying off 5,000 people. So the decline of the social contract has meant that many families, workers and their families, face far more insecurity, that they have to assume the risks of things like if they get injured on the job, or if they get ill, or if their kids, you know, break a leg and they don't have health insurance, that's a real disaster. And many people are discovering that without the good old pensions of old, when they retire, or if they try to retire, they just don't have enough money. I did a story recently, Eric, where I interviewed all these people in the young 60s who say, oh, I was planning to retire in 2 years or 4 years at the age of 65 or 66, but because of what's happened with my 401k, I got to work maybe till I'm 70, 75, 76. In my book, I write about a gentleman from St. Paul, Minnesota, who he thought he was retiring at age 67 when he needed bypass surgery for his heart. And here he is at age 72, 73, realizing that he doesn't have enough money in his 401k to support himself and his wife. So I explain how this person who worked 30 years for an insurance company now has to take two part-time jobs as a security guard just so he, you know, to support himself and his wife.
And what's so horrendous, especially on top of that, is that in these last three decades, the worker productivity has just burgeoned.
Yeah, there's been this, economists use this phrase, it's decoupling, not to sound, you know, like uppity, but, you know, in the past decade or so, until the past year, you know, corporate profits went up very well, economic production, GDP went up fairly nicely, and worker productivity rose, you know, very strongly. Yet, as I said, worker wages have basically been stagnant over the past decade, and people have to pay twice as much out of pocket for health insurance for their families as they did at the beginning of this decade. One of the weird things is that while wages have stagnated, the typical worker has to pay $1,700 more out of pocket than 7 years ago for health insurance. So in many ways, unfortunately, things are going backwards for workers. And yes, we have this economic recession over the past year, but my book points out that, you know, even before this economic recession hit, things were really going south. Things were getting worse for many, many workers. And the purpose of my book in many ways is to explain, you know, to readers, explain to the public, explain to, you know, politicians, even the folks in the Beltway, that there are a lot of things going wrong for workers, and we as a nation really have to step back and look at what's wrong and try to figure out what to do to turn things around.
Now, the other really point that jumped out at me, besides the rise and fall of the social contract, is the fact that most economists, most CEOs, CFOs will claim that they have to squeeze their workers harder because that's the only way they can make a profit. But you have a whole chapter of companies that do not do that and do nearly as well, in some cases better. And the big contrast is between Walmart, which is so notorious for mistreating its workers, and Costco, which treats them much better and does very well, thank you.
Yes. It's funny, people who read my book say, well, most of the best companies you single out is doing a great job are on the West Coast. There's something in the water that people in the West Coast drink. I do write about Costco. And, you know, Costco's founder, Jim Senegal, really decided from day one he wants to treat his workers well. And it's his vision that workers should be paid well and treated well, because that way they'll be loyal, they'll work hard, they'll be more productive, there'll be less turnover. And so the typical Costco worker who's been there 4.5 years makes about $46,000 a year when you include matching for the retirement plan. And the typical Walmart Sam's Club worker makes only about $25,000-$27,000 after 4.5 years. So there's a difference of about 60-70%. And when I interviewed Jim Sinegal, the CEO of Costco, he told me this funny story that every year Costco does a survey of its workers to ask them what's the best thing about working here, what's the worst thing about working here. And one year the worker said that the worst thing about working at Costco is that they're not allowed to wear shorts to work year-round. And I imagine if that were the worst thing at all the companies in the country, we'd be in pretty good shape. Another thing that struck me about Costco is the typical worker who's stayed there for more than a year stays at Costco for 17 years. There's great loyalty. And Jim Sinegal says that really helps create a more productive workforce. You know, the workers like it there, and they treat, and one result of that is they treat employees better. And in my book, I contrast that to Walmart. You know, Walmart doesn't pay nearly as well. Its health benefits, its retirement benefits aren't nearly as good. And I submit that Walmart generally doesn't attract a workforce that's as motivated or as loyal or as productive. And a lot of people, you know, who've read my book say, now I understand why the service at Costco is so much more efficient, you know, has more of a smile than the service at Walmart. I'm not saying there aren't, you know, some good workers at Walmart, but you know, I think the Costco system really helps ensure that the workers will generally be happier, more motivated, and more prosperous.
So why don't these other guys get it?
That's a good question. I think, you know, Walmart has concluded, and there was this famous, infamous internal memo at Walmart that another reporter and I broke exclusively a few years ago, where they said, you know, why should we at Walmart even have employees at, you know, who are there for 7 years and make, you know, 50% more than a new employee? I guess the Walmart view is experienced employees are hardly more productive, that employees are basically interchangeable, so they kind of hinted that perhaps Walmart should push out more experienced employees. And I think, you know, Walmart really puts huge emphasis on keeping its labor costs quite low, and it thinks that it works for them. I know I've interviewed some retail consultants who really have recommended that it would work better for Walmart if they paid their workers more, because then there'd be less turnover and better employee service and more productivity and perhaps less employee theft. But you know, clearly some employers are convinced that the high road is best, and some, like Walmart, are convinced that the low road is best.
The countervailing force against this for many decades was labor unions. That's no longer the case.
Well, labor unions, you're right, are far weaker than they used to be in decades past. And you know, I explain in the book why labor unions have gotten much weaker, and one reason is that there's much fiercer employer opposition to labor unions. In the 1950s, labor unions represented 35-40% of the private sector workforce, and I explain how, you know, once mighty unions like the United Auto Workers and United Steelworkers helped bargain these wonderful contracts with then prosperous General Motors and then prosperous Ford and United States Steel, and those contracts really helped create this wonderful social contract and, you know, the nation's middle class. Now, labor unions are much weaker. They represent only about 7.5% of workers in the private sector. There are whole industries where unions hardly have any power. And I think as a result of unions growing weaker, they cannot pressure companies as much to share their prosperity and profits with their workers. And it's harder for unions to, you know, pressure managers to treat workers decently. One of the big themes of my book, Eric, is that unfortunately many companies treat workers with a shocking lack of dignity. And I tell the story of a computer engineer in California who took his daughter to work on, his 8.5-year-old daughter to work on Take Your Daughters to Work Day. So what happens to him on that day? His boss fires him right in front of his daughter. I also tell the story of a software engineer up in Washington State, Myra Bronstein, She went to work for a software company that made software for cell phone companies, and she and the other employees were told, as long as you work hard, as long as the company is doing well, you'll have a job. Don't worry. And there's kind of this social contract. You know, you work hard for us, we'll take care of you. So Myra worked very hard. She often worked 14-hour days, 16-hour days, 18-hour days, trying to help the company get its software out as quickly as possible. And then one day, she and 17 other software engineers were called into a conference room, and the human resources director said, I'm sorry to tell you this, but you're being laid off. You're being fired. And they said, what? You know, you told us as long as the company's doing well, we'd have our job, and the company's doing well. And she said, I'm sorry, we're outsourcing your jobs to India. And they were shocked. And to add insult to injury, the human resources director said, and if you want to receive any severance pay whatsoever, you have to agree to spend the next 4 weeks training the workers from India who will be replacing you. And when I talk about companies doing something that kind of show a real lack of respect, that show a lack of dignity, I think those are good examples that managers of too many companies really don't treat workers with enough respect. They see them all too often as interchangeable parts. And I think when unions were stronger, and I think that's the point you're making, Eric, that forced companies to treat workers generally with more respect.
With the coming of the Obama administration, and especially Labor Secretary Hilda Solis, there was hope that it would be easier to unionize, that union certification procedures would be simplified. Do you still see hope for that?
Yes. I have a whole chapter about unions and the problems they face and what made them strong and what has made them weaker, and I describe how, unfortunately, many companies break the law, fire workers illegally, bully them illegally, all to keep unions out, and that how sometimes under the federal system it takes 4 or 6 years for illegally fired workers, for workers fired just for supporting a union, for them to get reinstated. And by that time, often the unionization drive, has fizzled, has flopped. So there's legislation that labor unions are pushing and that many Democrats are backing that would make it much easier for unions to organize workers. Perhaps, this new legislation would enable unions to unionize 3-5 million workers in just 2-3 years. And considering that labor's numbers have generally been falling over the past few decades, if unions could unionize 5 million people in 2-3 years, that would be a huge burst forward for them. The nation's businesses very much oppose this legislation because it would strengthen unions, and I think some businesses think that unions, especially in the private sector, are on their last legs. So, corporate America really wants to kill this legislation because they want to see unions continue to slide. And the legislation would make it easier for unions to organize workers because as soon as a majority of workers sign cards saying that they want to form a union, the legislation would give them the right to form a union. We would say management has to recognize the union. Under current law, the company can insist on a secret ballot election and a long, drawn-out, expensive campaign where companies often campaign very, very hard, spending sometimes millions of dollars to keep out a union. And unions say that the big problem is these campaigns in which the unions feel that companies break the law and unions are really not able to even step on company property to campaign at all on behalf of the union.
Because of our technical problems, we only have a minute or two to go. What do you think of the Obama administration? It's only been there for a couple of weeks. Do you think the stimulus package that was just passed will help American workers? Or in general, what do you think it'll accomplish?
In my book, I say we need a stimulus package and we need to rebuild.
And that was 2 years ago.
This was a year ago. We need to rebuild manufacturing. We need to improve our infrastructure. We need to increase spending on education because the United States is falling behind on education. And I think it's healthy for the country that there's a stimulus package that will help create jobs and help help create green jobs and help renovate our infrastructure. Now, I realize there's a big debate about whether the package is too big or too small. I don't presume to be expert enough to really say that. I mean, I sure hope, the nation is in deep economic yogurt right now, and I sure hope that the stimulus package and the bank bailout package will be able to pull us out of this mess. Because if not, the big squeeze we're in is going to get bigger and bigger.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I've been talking with Stephen Greenhouse, the labor and workplace correspondent for the New York Times, about his book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. And I have said it's a lot of the information in it is quite depressing, but it is wonderful to have all of this information in one place, and especially the examples of companies that are not applying the big squeeze and are still doing very well. So thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much, Eric. I really try to humanize what's happening to the nation's workers and kind of voice what's happening with workers. And I have a website, stephengreenhouse.com, that for people who want to learn more about the book.
Okay. Thanks so much, Stephen.
Thanks so much, Eric.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
This is Booktown again. You probably just heard me over that music talking with our next guest, Andrew McLeod, who is the author of Holy Cooperation, Building Graceful Economies, which does not deny any of the horrendous things Stephen Greenhouse was talking about in the first half of the program, but offers some very good alternatives. So welcome to Booktown, Andrew.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The book is very interesting, partly because it starts out with a brief discussion of your personal history, both with cooperative movements and your religious life, which have seemed to have alternated a bit. It's almost like a physics experiment in wave patterns, that they start out opposing one another or going in opposite directions and wind up in the end running together.
Yeah, that's a pretty good analogy. I hadn't thought of it that way before, but certainly, you know, when I first got involved with cooperatives, it was coming out of the radical anarchist movement in Minneapolis, and it was not a particularly religion-friendly environment, to say the least. And I even remember at one point some people who called themselves Christian anarchists came by this project that I was working on, and I remember just being completely baffled by that. But the way that it all sort of flowed together is that I started working at this worker-owned restaurant called the New Riverside Cafe that had originally been started in the 70s by a Catholic priest named Father William Tesca. And it never quite connected with me why someone would come from a Catholic background and try to create something where there was, you know, equal ownership, there was no boss, that was a very radical business form. But over the years, the more that I've studied, the more I've realized that there is a very long, a long-running intersection between cooperative economics and equality and justice with, you know, Christianity.
And you actually spend a fair amount of the book discussing the biblical roots of cooperative movements and how many examples of cooperation rather than authoritarianism there are in both the Old and New Testament. You told me before we went on that you didn't want to dwell too much on that because you wanted to deal more with what's going on today. But it was a fascinating example, set of examples, especially discussing the early history of Israel and the transition from judges to kings.
Sure. Yeah, and I mean, if I could just elaborate on that a little bit, basically the reason why I looked into that is because if you read in the New Testament, the book of Acts, which is the kind of the earliest history of the church, immediately after Jesus' departure, you find that there is this very new form of organizing that comes about. There's radical sharing of resources, and it talks about how there was no poverty among them as a result of this. They had elected leaders who were chosen by the community to manage the pooled resources that they had all brought together, and this was all voluntary, and these three things really do closely tie to what cooperatives are. Although it should also be noted that the cooperative movement as a whole is definitely a not a religious movement, and it does in fact have specific principles that says that there shouldn't be religious discrimination. So the examples that I'm looking at in the book, in some cases, wouldn't be considered co-ops per se, but they are definitely of a similar similar motivation.
Although some of the most strongly organized co-ops, especially in Spain and Italy, are in heavily Catholic countries, and that seems to have influenced their organization quite a lot.
Yeah, the Catholics have been very highly involved in this form of organizing, more than any other denomination that I've found. Although you could also say that, Islam has had its own high degree of cooperative organizing through its Islamic finance and through cooperative insurance organizations that they have. And then similarly, the history of Israel also has a very strong cooperative thread running throughout its early decades. But the Catholics, not just in Europe, but also even here in the U.S., have been pretty active in starting co-ops. Back in the years following the Great Depression, there was a very large movement in the upper Midwest where various parishes were organizing credit unions and food co-ops. I believe there were about 700 parishes that were engaged in this type of organizing. And then in the South, during the period of the Civil Rights Movement, there was an African-American priest named A.J. McKnight, who was leading an effort to organize consumer co-ops and a credit co-op that helped to start a bakery that was owned by its workers and really provided a really valuable way for people to find a productive response to a lot of racism that was going on in the economy at that time.
So now we've gone briefly through the history of co-ops and the interaction of co-ops with religious movements. But what is the real value of co-ops? Why not just go out and start a business and make as much money as you can?
Well, I think that if you're looking at it from a pragmatic point of view, without getting into the religious teachings, that we can see the results of concentration of wealth and power, and that's a lot of what your previous guest talked about is. How there are these people that are making decisions that are basically reinforcing their positions of privilege and wealth, and it's creating more and more difficulty for everyone else, and especially for the people who are trying to make a living working for those employers. And there are exceptions. I mean, certainly there are organizations like Costco that do treat their workers well, but ultimately they don't have to. When you start looking at some other models that are more based on common ownership, you really do start finding something that not only works better in terms of maintaining social stability and general peace over the long run, but also fits in much better with Christian teachings of social justice.
A fair way, toward the end of the book, you have a statement of cooperative identity, which was originally written, or I guess its first form was the Rochdale Principles laid out by English workers in Manchester in 1844, and it's now been updated by the International Cooperative Alliance. And it has 7 points, which seem to me very sensible, although you point out that when they can conflict a bit with religiously organized cooperatives. They work very well for secular ones.
Yeah.
I could read off the points, or should we?
Sure.
Okay,
sure,
number one is voluntary and open membership. Number two is democratic member control. Number three, member economic participation. Four, autonomy and independence. Five, education, training, and information. Six, cooperation among cooperatives. And seven, concern for community.
Right, and this is this forms the basis for one of the chapters in the book, which is where I've already established that if you're following the teachings of Jesus, you should also be taking seriously this business model. But then in that chapter, I turn it around and say, well, okay, but is what the Bible teaches about organization exactly what co-ops are, or are there some differences? And they use these 7 principles as kind of a yardstick, and comes up with, there are some differences. Like, for example, it's not exactly clear that the Bible teaches democratic decision-making in the same sense that we understand it. It may be something closer to consensus decision-making rather than majority rule. But you know, generally speaking, there's pretty good overlap among these. One of the more challenging issues, I think, is going to be looking at the issue of when you have a faith-based cooperative organization that wants to discriminate based on religion and only wants to open itself to people who believe in a certain way. I think that's going to be where there's going to be some tension between the larger cooperative movement and between these faith-based organizations. But there are some positive exceptions around that. Like, for example, there's a co-op called Greenfield Farms, which was organized by Amish and Old Order Mennonite farmers in the upper Midwest. And they have been working with a larger co-op called Crop, which is the producers of Organic Valley milk and soy milk. And they have basically gotten the help of this larger secular co-op, even though they are very clearly, making a religious discrimination in their membership. The larger co-op realized that, you know, there's a good reason for that. So I think that there's some room for overlap. But ultimately, we might be talking about two somewhat different movements. But my hope is that there is at least room for positive interaction in those cases. And certainly, I think that there's also a lot of room for people to organize this way out of their religious background without making religious discriminations, just to realize that, you know, this is just a way to share with their neighbors, to take better care of their brothers and sisters, and to, for example, organize a food co-op in their neighborhood if they don't have good access to grocery stores. Like, there are many towns where the only grocery store in town is struggling and maybe even closing down. So there's some real opportunities for faith communities to work together with their neighbors and create something that I think everyone could welcome.
We talked 10 minutes ago about the convergence between your cooperative feelings or cooperative inclinations and your religious ones. Where has that got you now?
Well, I've been involved with a church called Flood, based in Sacramento. And we've had, at this point, we're a fairly young group, and we're still figuring out exactly what this all looks like. But one of the things that we are moving along with is putting in a garden. We're planning on putting in a community garden to help, you know, grow food, starting with for our own members, but then, assuming that we're successful enough, we'll start sharing it with people outside of our immediate community. And I've also recently got back from a five-week book tour, in which I visited many communities that are further along. Some of these include groups that have been, you know, living together in community for, you know, decades and have many businesses that they use to bring in most of their income that are all collectively held. These include a couple in Chicago. There's one of them is called Breba Place Fellowship. Another is called Jesus People USA. I've also, been finding out about other groups that are organizing things that are a little bit less communal in nature, but also have a much higher potential to create broader social and economic transformation. And one of these is, which I haven't had a chance to visit yet, is called Mondragon. This is in the Basque Country of Spain, and it was originally started back in the 50s by the graduates of a trade school that was started by a Catholic priest. And this organization has grown to include about 100,000 employees now. They have about one of the largest banks in Spain. They have the largest they have one of the largest grocery store chains in the country. They have their own social security, their own educational system, their own hospitals, and they built this all voluntarily. It's not based on trying to seize control of the government and impose Christian values. It's based on creating an alternative that better fits what they see as those values, and hoping that it becomes appealing enough that other people will join it. And incidentally, they've been doing very well. They certainly are not perfect, and they do some things that are not exactly in line with the original intents and values and whatnot. But they've certainly done much better than the businesses around them. For example, during the 70s and 80s, there was a very severe recession in Spain. And during that time, as always, the co-op never had to lay anyone off. They always managed to find ways to keep people employed.
And although Spain is a heavily Catholic country, it's not a formally Catholic co-op.
Right, right. And it does keep, you know, Catholic values as part of its kind of its genetic blueprint, as part of its reason for existence. But you don't have to be Catholic to join it, and it doesn't. It's not a faith-based organization.
And it's primarily concerned with teachings of Jesus rather than church doctrine or.
Yeah, I wouldn't even necessarily say that it's primarily concerned with that. I think at this point, it's primarily concerned with building the Basque community and helping the Basque people to live better, both in terms of their you know having their needs taken care of, but also living more moral lives. But this does happen to you know overlap quite a bit with the teachings of Jesus. But I don't think they would necessarily describe it in those terms overall.
Now, your church in Sacramento, you just said it's called Flood. That mm-hmm. sounds very non-denominational.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
How is it organized? What is its purpose?
Well, we actually share a space with another church called Sacramento Asian American Ministries, and they meet in the mornings and we meet in the evenings. And each group has its own kind of leadership committee. And then there's kind of a combined group that coordinates between the two congregations.
Okay, it's about almost 10 minutes of, and I'm expecting our next guest, Charles Durrett, a local architect, but he's not here now. So
okay.
I just want to say a little bit about, in case he doesn't make it, about what is happening. Oh, is that? No, that's not him. That's Jimmy Accardi, who's going to be here in 10 minutes. Anyway, Charles Durrett is one of the, he and his wife, Katie McCammett, are the owners of the co-housing company, and they're the people who've really brought the concept of co-housing to the United States. They've written several books about it. He has a new book on senior co-housing just coming out, and they've built two co-housing communities in Nevada County, one in Nevada City and one in Grass Valley. And he'll be speaking on designing and living a green life this Wednesday, the 18th at 7 p.m. at the Nevada City Veterans Hall on North Pine Street in Nevada City. If you want more information, you can call 218-2027. But that gives us, Andrew, a little more time to talk. And
sure.
If Charles comes in, we'll just put him in the conversation.
Sure, sounds great.
There have been so many cooperative movements. One of the somewhat encouraging and then somewhat depressing things about your book is you talk about going way back to the Old Testament where the more cooperative, somewhat rule by judges in ancient Israel was superseded by that of kings, and how the early Christian church, which you say was really you call it the ecclesia, really means a gathering. It was a group of gatherings, gradually got centralized by the Catholic Church and lost a lot of some of its cooperative feeling. And then there have been cooperative movements in the last 200 or 300 years following the Reformation, the English Civil War in the United States in the 18th and 19th centuries, and most of these have faded away. What do you feel about the hope for cooperatives in the future now?
Yeah. Well, I think that there's one thing that the cooperative movement hasn't always done very well is to maintain real ongoing education to keep people aware of why the co-ops are important. One of the dynamics that often happens is co-ops are created in response to a need. Often this is in response to a financial crisis such as the Great Depression. And there's this, you know, very obvious need that people meet by organizing. But once that co-op has been going for a number of years or even a generation, people don't remember what it was like beforehand, so they start taking it for granted. And for that reason, I think it's really important to keep looking at what is the big picture, why is this important. Incidentally, I'm taking a master's program through St. Mary's University in Nova Scotia master's in management of cooperatives and credit unions, which is pretty much an MBA on cooperative business offered through an accredited business school. Now, and And there's also a need to, you know, just to kind of keep building new co-ops, to keep, you know, keep new generations going, because any organization as it grows and ages is going to change. I often like to look at an analogy of how forests grow. And you start out with small shrubs and small plants, and they can only do so much. And that's somewhat like what you have here in the U.S., where you have these individual co-ops that are not necessarily very well linked. In some cases they are, but not always. But then as the system matures, you start seeing things more like what you see over in the Basque Country, or also in Italy, where you have millions of people involved, and some of the largest grocery companies in the country are cooperatives. And there you start seeing something more like a mature forest where there's higher forms of organization are possible. But even in those cases, you still have the situation where the individual organizations age. And for that reason, I think it's important to always be building new cooperatives and new projects that meet people's needs based on what's happening now. And you know, we're moving into another period in which I think there's going to be a large degree of this type of organizing happening. Already we're seeing, towns that have been faced with losing their last department store organizing community buyouts to keep the store open. These aren't always exactly cooperatives, but they're very much motivated by the same types of impulses.
And I can think of one example that fits what you were just saying about the difficulty of maintaining organizations, and that is that the whole credit union movement, which was very strong in the 30s and 40s, is still going, but most people don't know much about it. And most people, when they think of a bank, they think of a profit-making bank, and forget that they might be able to go to a credit union and get much better terms than they can from a regular bank. On the other hand, I don't think any credit unions have been implicated in any of the balloon that we've just seen burst. Do you know anything about that?
Right, sure. And I think that, you know, there certainly is a lot of room for improvement in terms of how credit unions could be presenting themselves as different from banks. There's been some really great progress recently, but it's sort of a somewhat new development. But it is true that the credit unions are doing much better than the banks are, and there's a reason for that. It's because banks need to be as profitable as possible, so they've been driven to get into these progressively more dangerous experiments, which have now, as we've all seen, blown up in their faces. And credit unions, in contrast, have a mission of meeting their members' needs. And they should, you know, bring some sort of a return, but they don't have to be the most profitable out there. So they've been able to, you know, continue along being much more conservative in their investment practices and in their lending practices. And as a result, they didn't get into a lot of the trouble that many of the larger investor-controlled banks have. And it should also be noted there are a lot of smaller community banks that have also done very well, because they've also tended to be more conservative.
And on the other hand, I was using them as an example of co-ops that started 50, 60, 70 years ago and are less obvious now. But certain things like co-op grocery stores and community-supported agriculture have been flourishing and sprouting up everywhere in the last 5 or 6 years of apparent prosperity.
Yes, yeah, that's true. That's true, but I also think that there's a need to get back to some of the more traditional forms that food co-op organizing has taken now that we are back in harder times. Historically, food co-ops have not been natural food stores. They haven't been a niche market. And while I do definitely think that that's a great it's a great business model for that type of market, I think that there's much more potential than that. And I really hope that we start seeing more examples where people start realizing that food co-ops are a way of making food more affordable to people and making it more accessible to people, and dealing with these sorts of justice issues that we really urgently need to deal with.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm almost out of time. Just want to let you know that I've been talking with Andrew McLeod, author of Holy Cooperation, Building Graceful Economies. And he's going to be in Grass Valley at 10:30 a.m. next Saturday at a location, unfortunately, I can't name. But if you look around, you'll probably see some posters. It should be on the KVMR community calendar. It should be in the union. And if not, maybe you can figure it out on your own. I'm looking forward to meeting him. Well, I've already met him once, but seeing him more and talking more about what's in this book. So that's going to be somewhere in Grass Valley, 10:30 next Saturday morning. And also Charles Durrett, who wasn't able to get here today, is going to be talking about designing and living a green life this Wednesday at the Nevada City Veterans Hall at 7 p.m. And you can call 218-2027 for more information. Do you have a number where people can call you?
Sure. Actually, a better way to reach me would be through my email. It's COOPGUS@gmail.com.
Okay, that sounds really easy. So this is Andrew McLeod. Thanks so much, and I'm glad you were there to talk more when Charles wasn't able to turn up.
My pleasure. I'm sorry he couldn't make it.
Yeah, and stay tuned now for Jimmy Icardi's Rock and Roll Party.